The Home Show.
With Colour Trend. Infinite colour from Ireland.
This is News Talk.
Hello, and you're very welcome along to the latest episode of The Home Show podcast. I'm your host, Sinead Ryan. Coming up this week, as part of our life-changing events series, we're going to look at how to reclaim the space around you after divorce with our psychotherapist and interior design team. Our summer garden series heads to Japan, but actually no further than Kildare. The discovery of 17th century basement homes under a Dublin 2 city street and the Diderot effect. Do you suffer from it? We'll be finding out all about it from Paul Kinsler. If you'd like to get in touch with us here on the Home Show podcast, we do love hearing from listeners. You can email us throughout the week at thehomeshow@newstalk.com, and you can find me over on social media on Instagram and X, and you'll find me there as Sinead Ryan. If you miss any of the bits, of course, they are all up on podcast, going back now as far as our podcast history goes, many, many years, and you're very welcome along. Now, divorce is a long and difficult process, and many people feel that they lose themselves through it. But reclaiming your life after separation can often leave your home with sad memories. So here to help us navigate the difficult journey and reclaim our space is our crack team. Denise O'Connor of Optimised Design joins me in studio, and clinical psychotherapist Stephanie Regan is on the line. Ladies, you're very welcome along. Stephanie, let me start with you. You know, this can be a traumatic time for many. And, you know, even the spouse that's left in the marital home. And look, your key focus maybe throughout this is on your kids, your finances, holding it all together. There's not much headspace for our surroundings and our decor.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it. You know, there isn't much headspace or bandwidth to deal with that kind of issue. And yet it's an issue that can sort of, you know, how would I say, sort of really reflect your emotions and kind of affect your emotions as you go forward. So I think it is something really worth mentioning, that you your environment matters, and how you navigate your home post-divorce matters. Now, obviously, it's different whether you are alone or whether you are with your children or adult children, as can be often the case. I know young children can happen too. But there is a kind of a need for an emotional reset, for a kind of a clearing out of some reminders, some of the past, not an abandoning of it, but just any of the points of the past that are very triggering for you, or that you find very difficult, or, you know, that just bring sadness. I think it's really important to move them aside in a way that is helpful to you and helpful to your mood, and maybe to bring in something new, you know, to bring in something fresh, that may be just fresh decor, doesn't have to be like big expensive fresh buying, but, you know, fresh decor, fresh spaces, fresh colours, fresh uses, I think, as well. You know, I would often think of, if you can switch the functionality of rooms, that makes a big difference, I think, to how you feel in them. So there's lots of things, even from my own side, and I'm not on the designy side, obviously, but I would often feel like that myself at different points, that, you know, when the weather changes or something, you like to move your spaces around. And I think it's something like that. It reflects your inner mood. And you can work with that and make it work for you.
Now, you know, that sense of, and that idea of reclaiming your own space, because if you're now going to be living in this house on your own, as opposed to as part of a couple, you're going to have gaps, obviously, but, you know, physically, you're going to have gaps, but that can get filled kind of with more clutter. In terms of, you know, that ownership piece, where maybe you made joint decisions before now on the colour of the walls or the type of sofa you had. How important is it to put your own stamp back on things from a psychological perspective?
You're asking me there, Sinead, and I think psychologically it's really important. It's about in many ways making that step to singledom, if you like. You know, being able to, be, you know, not trying to continue to create the home that you were creating together, but rather to create a home, still a home, that is a reflection of you, with a kind of vibrancy that is your own, and with an energy that comes from you. And I think that it's part of, you have to be kind of in some way healed a little bit to do that. I think that's another point. It's a kind of, it will reflect your psychological kind of movement forward. And I don't think people should feel bad if they're not ready to do that at the outset. But I would hear it a lot as, as the person who's recovering, that, you know, when they're over the trauma a little bit, where they have adjusted to and begun to realize that maybe this was the right step at this time, even if in the beginning they didn't want it. And I think it's almost like a click, you know, like a click on the clock, that that there's a point when you're ready to make changes like that. And I hear sometimes, I hear women and men coming in and saying, you know, they've done the garden up. They meant to do it forever. They never seem to have the money. They never seem to have the time. And now they're, you know, giving it the time. They find themselves out there and they enjoy it, and they sit in the evening and they're there. Or they've changed a room that, you know, that was a, you know, a spare bedroom, was a dump room, and now they've changed it into a space where they can write or where they can explore their work or where they're working and looking out in the area that they want, and it all feels nice, bright, be it pink, be it whatever, but that it's more girly or it's more manly. I heard one extraordinary story, if I may mention, where somebody had changed the dining room into a kind of more like a garage. Now, this was a man who did this, but I think this was quite funny, and actually I quite enjoyed it. And they had a boat that they'd been fixing for years outside in the backyard, and when they were divorced, they threw it into the dining room and did it in comfort with the music going. And I thought, well, good on you.
Yeah. Right. Very. Maybe, of course, that was one of the reasons that he found himself divorced. Who knows? Right.
But maybe not.
Let me turn to Denise O'Connor here in studio. Denise, that kind of out with the old, in with the new.
Yes.
Stephanie was indicating there, it can be kind of cathartic in one place to kind of reclaim that and say, look, I can finally do what I wanted to do here.
Yeah.
But there's a balance. Is there a damage maybe in throwing out too much?
Absolutely. And you see this with any kind of change or transition in a house. I think Stephanie hit the nail on the head where she said, you need to be ready for this. So it's not something to do immediately as this has happened, because the risk there is that you're so emotionally overwhelmed that you're just going to throw everything out. And suddenly you're left with nothing, and that's not a good thing either. So I think it's, you know, allow yourself the time to come to peace with where you are now and try to look to the future and figure out how you want to be, how you want to live in the house, how you want to feel in the spaces, and then sort of try and view each room, go room by room. So it's not a huge overwhelming task, but just approach it in that way. So, you know, what represents me? How do I want to use this room? How do I want to repurpose this room? I'm laughing about the boat. I'm thinking my own husband is mad into motorbikes. I can only imagine what the house would be like. But, you know, so just go through the spaces and have a bit of fun. Like a story like that, okay, it's extreme. But, you know, you want to sort of see the positive in this as a new start, a fresh start. And
okay, so simple things you could do that maybe you're not going to regret, or you're not going to, it's not a complete overhaul. You're not taking down a wall.
Yes.
But what are the things that we can do? Because I'm thinking there might be people out there who maybe want to get rid of some photographs or maybe art that reminded them of the other person, or maybe a piece of furniture that they bought that you never liked.
Exactly.
But you also might have some legal steps to go through that you can't really start getting rid of everything. So it gives an idea of maybe even just putting away things or kind of minor glow-ups, if you like.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, often what we would see as well, it's funny, like the ideal scenario is that when people are living in a house together, that the house reflects both of them. But often it's just not the case. You'll find that there's one personality who really takes charge when it comes to the decor and one who's a little bit more reserved. So depending on your circumstance, whether you were the one that sort of took charge or weren't, that's going to have a big impact on how you move forward. And I think you're absolutely right. Much better to sort of go room by room, take a look at the room, look at the pieces in the room. Are they things you like? Do they have good memories, bad memories? You know, are they emotionally triggering? And pack them away, store them away, whether that means taking a storage unit or finding a spare room in the house where you can put things away. Don't get rid of it straight away, because you might regret that, or there may be issues where you simply can't. But use the opportunity to cull, I would say, and sort of then you're able to view each space with fresh eyes and maybe decide how you want to move forward.
And of course, there's an element of being able to spread out a little bit more. I mean, you've half a wardrobe now to migrate into.
Yeah, exactly.
you know, drawers and cupboards maybe that you hadn't before.
That's right. There's opportunity, and there's opportunities to repurpose rooms or to create that exercise space that you always wanted, or set up the ideal home office, or even if you have children, get them involved a little bit. And what would they like, and what would improve their spaces too? So really try and view it as a fresh start.
Okay, let me go back to Stephanie there for a moment, because you mentioned Denise their children. And look, when we're going through this difficult period, and especially if you've younger children, they're first and foremost. How important is it, Stephanie, to ensure that their personal space is honoured in this way? I mean, I presume children crave comfort and familiarity above all things during a traumatic change like divorce.
Exactly. And I suppose when there are children, it really does change that quite a little bit, I think, because their spaces are their spaces too, and they reflect something for them. And I would see that as an important kind of consistency or a point of consistency to them, that things don't change in too much. In other words, you don't want them to feel that the whole world is changing. You want them to feel that their world is stable. Mm. And so I probably would be doing less of the removal with children at that time. As Denise said there, maybe later on, they might like to get involved in the fun of making some positive changes.
Okay.
You know, with colour or with places later. But just in terms of their bedroom and their spaces and places, I would probably not be changing that. And I suppose that also brings up the point of, you know, if somebody is divorcing and there is anger, and there is almost always anger and disappointment in play somewhere along the way for either of the adult parties. And the question is, how do, you know, removing triggers for the adult is removing the past for the child as well. So you that has to be, in many ways, defused emotionally. And often it isn't. And often, as we know, the damage that children often see is this kind of, you know, rejection of the other party and this anger with the parent that has divorced or left or whatever. So I think it's important that that isn't, in many ways, an anger-fueled kind of declutter or an anger-fueled reshaping of the home.
Yeah.
But if a person doesn't have children, then I think you're in a very different, different page entirely.
Indeed. And of course, Denise, there are people now who are perfectly happy that their other half is gone and they're delighted to be rid of them out of the space. So is there a possibility we could do too much too soon and reclaim everything and chuck out the baby with the bathwater?
Throw everything out. And Stephanie's absolutely right. For the children, then that could be very traumatic. So there is that sort of balance there of how to manage that, because, you know, all these things will have a lot of sentimental attachment to the kids.
Yeah, exactly. So you have to kind of take it slowly in some ways.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But there are small little things we can do. When you know, you talked about reimagining furniture and pictures and that, but like, you can make very temporary changes, like painting a wall and sticking pink cushions on if that's your thing.
And look, repainting is always a great thing to do. So, you know, take the opportunity to maybe refresh it, introduce different colours, introduce colours that you really like, you know, just give a space, particularly a space that you spend a lot of time in, like a living space or an open plan area. It's a brilliant space to start with.
Fantastic. All right. Well, Denise O'Connor of Optimised Design, Stephanie Regan from Stephanie Regan Therapy, thank you very much for joining us on The Home Show today. And we will be doing a fourth and final episode in this series of, you know, reclaiming your space after life events, major life events. We will bring that to you quite soon. Ladies, thank you very, very much for all of that.
The Home Show
with Colour Trend. Infinite colour from Ireland.
This is News Talk. The Home Show
with Colour Trend. Infinite colour from Ireland.
This is News Talk.
If you're needing and looking for headspace and a little bit of peace and quiet, well, you need go no further than my next guest. In this week's part of our ongoing Gardens of Ireland series, we turn to an Irish favourite, the Japanese gardens at the National Stud in County Kildare, an ancient art form, traditional roots. Japanese gardens can be found throughout the world, and we're lucky to have the world-renowned Japanese gardens in County Kildare. And I'm delighted to welcome into studio its head gardener, John Smith. You're very welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Now, if anybody hasn't been, and they should be, but if they haven't, talk to me about the sense of tranquility you get when you arrive into the Japanese gardens. It's a little bit incongruous in the, you know, plains of County Kildare, adjacent to the National Stud, you know. Why there? And tell us a little bit about it.
Well, actually, it's funny you say that, because a couple of years ago, I visited the National Stud and the Japanese gardens because I hadn't been. And went in, and I was trying to get my head around the context of why this Japanese gardens was in the middle of a big, you know, Irish National Stud. And a little bit of the history and a little bit of background to it is that William Hall Walker, who moved to Tully in 1896, he established a stud. And in around 1901, he would have been influenced by Japanese culture and Japanese gardens. And there was a lot of exhibitions at the time. There was one, I think, in 1901 in Scotland. And that may have influenced him, him being a Scottish, son of a Scottish brewer and a very wealthy man and horse breeder. So I think he would have been influenced to build the Japanese gardens. And it was very, you know, this is what wealthy people did. They added a walled garden or a Victorian or Baroque or whatever it was at the time. And Japanese gardens was in vogue then. So he obviously went and commissioned Tasa Aida, a Japanese garden designer, builder, and his son Minoru to come to Tully. And with local labour force of up to about 40 people, over 4 years, they built the Japanese gardens. So what makes it unusual is that it is a story of man. And when you go into the Japanese gardens, and what I think is lost on some people sometimes is the design behind it.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a garden designer, so I know that if I was given the brief of designing a garden in the story of man, it would be very, very difficult.
So it's like a journey through life, isn't it?
Yeah.
It starts out in childhood, and it's kind of more playful and colourful and all that. So tell us about the other elements.
So when you come into the garden, you're in oblivion, so you haven't been born yet. And you're greeted by these beautiful specimens of cloud-pruned chamois cypress, which is basically, you know, relates to our Leylandi. But they're manipulated into beautiful form. So you can see the branches and the cloud-pruned. And also in the background, you have the adults. So you see what it would have liked, what it would have looked like, you know, if it wasn't touched or manipulated. So you see all these beautiful things, and then you're led into, which is the beginning of the cycle where you're kind of, you're born, and the cave of birth. And from there, you're led along some paths into the darkness, where you come out of that and you're educated. And all along the path, you're given the options of the easy path or the difficult path, the difficult route. And you ascend to be educated, and you see these large pine trees, which is the mature, which is the, you know, where you need to be. And the, also the pitfall behind that, the hole, whereas that if you're too cocky, you can fall down, you can be injured, you know. So you're led through this, and then you're on the kind of, I suppose, the gap year, where you're the exciting part of the stepping stones and the water's flowing. And from those points, you, all along the sides, you have, you know, the beautiful designed rock and the magnificent building and architecture of the garden, and also the green infrastructure, which is beautiful also. So you're kind of blown away by all this. Now, it's very small, and it's quite quite narrow. So from there, then you're given the option, you'll come to a crossroads, which is very similar, you know, in life, where you may take the single path, or you may choose to cross onto the island where you are, you meet your partner and the Red Bridge and all the significance of that, all to the point of the Hill of Ambition, where you'll see the well and the tea house and all the beautiful things. And you eventually will end up, you know, eternity. You'll meet the gates.
And it is an extraordinary thing. And you need to kind of, when you're there, totally slow down and take your time, because as you say, it is very small, and understand the significance of all of it. And it has everything. It has the Red Bridge, which is iconic.
Yeah.
It has the flowing water. It's a tea garden. And, you know, when I think of Japanese, my little knowledge of it, culture, I'm thinking, certainly in terms of gardens, I'm thinking of bonsai, and I'm thinking of still water. And it, you do incorporate those elements. How difficult is it as a gardener to transplant and maintain some of those plants and shrubs, which don't belong here at all?
No, the some of the original plants, there is, in the literature, it says that he bought, Hall Walker brought over a shipload of, you know, antiquities for the garden, and chikimis and lanterns and all of that, but also a lot of bonsais and a lot of cloud prune trees. So a lot of the plants in the garden are still originals. So some of them are about 150 years old.
Wow.
And
okay. No pressure, John.
Well, if I lose them on my watch, that's it, you know.
And you do have new residents into the stud as well, into the gardens as well, because you have koi, which are a very Japanese-like form of goldfish,
yeah.
Probably is the nearest thing. Now, you know, you have to be careful with those because they go munchy munchy for other animals. They're kind of lunch. So how do you mind them?
Well, one of the things is we have one of the greatest koi ponds and construction of engineering I think I've ever seen in the country.
Yeah.
It's magnificent. And when I came to the job last year, I said, where's the koi? And there's some difficulty. As you know, we had mink farms which were kind of closed in 2022. And those mink were released into the wild, into the Midlands. So they've been kind of decimating everything.
Yeah, you know, and they're vicious things, aren't they? Yeah.
So they particularly like koi,
yeah.
And fish. Yeah. So, and also we have the heron too, which is a protected bird.
Yum, yum. They're going. Yeah.
And we're huge into biodiversity at the stud. So protecting the heritage, but also getting the koi in there is a big thing for me because it's an immersive experience for the public and they love koi. People stand there for hours watching it.
Mm.
So we have been working with our wildlife team and our officers there to try and reintroduce the koi. So we have contacted a lot of organizations, a lot of people that are big into koi, and Seahorse Aquariums, Keelan, has come on board with us and he's helping us understand.
We had him on the home show a couple of years ago with his seahorses in a jar. It was magic to see them, and he's so intense on all of that conservation. So koi, you know, they really are associated with Japanese culture and Japanese gardens. So it's obviously very important to kind of get that balance right, isn't it?
Yeah, and like racehorses, they go back, the lineage goes back thousands of years. So he knows that really, really well. And my ambition is to get the koi pond full of koi again.
Okay.
And to do that, we've been understanding, we've been filming the heron, we've been trying to manipulate the environment so we can get this right. And that's going to be a big project
big to project
get the koi
to
back in. So
fantastic.
All right. Tequila.
Okay, now, where can people find out more, John, if they are inspired to go and visit the Japanese gardens and indeed the National Stud, of course, which is down there as well?
Well, they can obviously follow us on Instagram or Facebook. We have a big social media following. I do a lot on the Japanese gardens myself. That's John at the Stud on Instagram. So we do daily updates all the time. We've a great website. We've lots of different events happening all the time. There'll be the big colour change now come October. So we'd appreciate if people come down to see that.
Wonderful.
And that is lovely. And then we've lots of events. We've lots of events happening throughout the year. So it's a great team and very exciting place. And it's great to see the public down and see the eyes lighting up in the gardens.
Yeah, indeed. It really is extraordinary. And it is one of our very, very special gardens in Ireland. So thank you, John, for coming in and telling us all about and reminding some of us about the wonders of the Japanese gardens at the National Stud. Now, during recent roadworks, the basements of demolished 18th century houses were unearthed on York Street, just around the corner here from us at News Talk. These basements had lain dormant inches beneath the surface for the last few decades. So what do we know about the architecture of these old buildings, and should they ever have been demolished in the first place? Well, joining me now is Graeme Hickey, CEO of the Dublin Civic Trust. To answer these questions, Graeme, describe what was found.
Morning, Sinead. It was really extraordinary just walking along York Street, looking over the plastic fences of the usual roadworks. And rather than the damp clay and the rusty water mains that you usually expected in holes in Dublin, here we are looking straight into the former rooms, the basement rooms of Georgian houses that originally lined that section of York Street. And as you say, it's pretty unusual to find archaeology so close to the surface, immediately under the pavement. In the city. And I suppose that's a quirk of the type of development that took place in the mid-20th century, where slum clearance or housing improvement, as it was called at the time, kind of resulted in new flat schemes that were built back from the street line. It's kind of poor urban practice in today's terms. But back then, new flat schemes were removed from the street line. So they just simply covered over the basements. In fact, the basements actually formed pretty handy receptacles for the landfill for the collapsed Georgian houses that were literally collapsed into their own footings.
It's crazy. And I mean, these flats that are there now, which I have to say are not a testament to lovely architecture in any way. They're pretty ugly. You know, we must have known, or they must have known, what the original properties looked like. Is there a record of them? Are there photographs of them? Do we know where they're commercial, residential?
There is. There's pretty good photos from the mid-20th century, and I've just brought in one aerial photo there. I know your listeners can't see it, but extraordinary photo from 1936.
So these were beautiful, substantial Georgian buildings.
Large-scale, four-storey buildings.
This would have been very middle, upper class, or were they?
Very much.
Yeah.
And of course, York Street itself predates the Georgian period, and I suppose we'll get onto that about the extraordinary lineage of the Angel Street area. But in fact, York Street was a 17th century street, so in large part, a lot of the houses that we're looking at that were demolished were actually replacements of 17th century houses that formerly existed on the site.
So this is a very ancient area, and, you know, I think it's worth reminding ourselves, because we get a mangled history sometimes about, you know, landed gentry and British rule and all that. But Dublin was sophisticated. It was upmarket. You know, there were a lot of very wealthy people living around both the Fitzwilliam Squares, the Stephen's Greens, and also this part of town as well.
Absolutely. And perhaps we have a perception that the 18th century was the period of enlightenment and continental urban design principles. But in fact, the 17th century is when things really kick off after the restoration of the monarchy in 1660, the setting out of Stephen's Green by Dublin Corporation, the setting out of the quays and the houses actually fronting onto the river in a way that previously wasn't conceived. And then Sir Francis Ainger, who was the real mover and shaker in Dublin in the
16th century.
Of Ainger Street. He had actually inherited from his grandparents the whole Whitefriars estate, the monastic estate, and we're all familiar with the Carmelite monastery and church that exists in its current form there today. But he really saw an opportunity after the Restoration that his estate, which was clamped between Stephen's Green and Dublin Castle, that it could become the de facto kind of St. James's Square in London, close to the St. James's Court, that the Ainger Street would be close to Dublin Castle and the Viceregal Court. So he set out Ainger Street, which was the first planned residential suburb in Dublin. The street was 70 feet wide, which it still is to this day, which was about double the width of an average street in late medieval and post-medieval Dublin at the time. And he was successful for the first 20 years in attracting high-class residents of bishops and earls to build large-scale mansions fronting Ainger Street. And so, a lot of those houses, amazingly, still survive behind later facades.
Yeah, so a great vision, really, about what these boulevards could look like, because they could be modelled on, you know, the families that they had come from. What, in terms of what we can tell from the structures that remain and these basements that you've uncovered, what marks out kind of 17th century from the later 18th and 19th century in terms of how these houses were used? Because, of course, everybody was on, you know, horses and carriages and gatehouses and all that kind of thing.
It's a really good question because, again, we tend to think of the Georgian brick city, but brick becomes the de facto, the standard building material in Dublin from about 1630 onwards. So by the 1660s, when Ainger Street was being set out, brick was absolutely well established. So these were brick-built houses. What kind of defines them as a little bit differently to what came later is that they were, I suppose, the craftsmen and the builders of the time, they operated within a tradition. So they were still clinging on to the older timber-caged ideas of building buildings substantially with timber. So these buildings have brick carcasses, but they still have massive timber beams embedded in the floors. Very often you have a drop-down beam in the middle of the drawing room or the parlour, which would never have been accepted in the 18th century, but that was all part of the language of the time. And one of the buildings that Dublin Civic Trust restored in the 1990s, number 21 Ainger Street,
that's right,
it still retains its spectacular 17th century 1660s staircase rising up the centre of the building. So it's very different. We think of Georgian stairs as very delicate. This is a massive staircase with kind of vase-shaped balusters or pear-shaped balusters. And another one survives in number 9 and 9A Ainger Street, which people might be familiar with. It was open for open house for many years. So that's the type of kind of more heavy style architecture that existed in the 17th century.
Now, of course, the whole lot, because this discovery has been because they are redoing these flats, social housing that was built in the 1960s. So these were all demolished to put up flats. Now, that couldn't happen now, or could it?
Indeed. That's the great tragedy, I suppose. And it's really quite interesting to juxtapose the demolition of the Georgian terraces in the mid-century to provide newer, modern housing. Mm. Whereas nowadays, I think the approach is correct, where the Glover's Court, a flat complex directly across the road from where this hole is being very successfully redeveloped in the coming years by Dublin City Council. There's a lovely new scheme by DTA architects and by the council to kind of retain the concrete carcass of the buildings, to completely reclad them, to add new stories on top. So there's a net contribution in the number of housing units, with a whole new architectural frontage onto the street and with great thermal performance and wonderful amenity for the residents.
Yeah, but is there a danger with the, especially with the 2000 Planning Act, where everything that has heritage value like is totally maintained? There's no room for movement. It can be very stymieing, maybe, of development, of new development and more modern placeholding that goes on. It's hard to get that balance right, isn't it?
It can be tricky. I suppose in this case that they're being retained on the basis of embodied carbon. A different approach would be seen at the Dorset Street flats, which have been completely demolished. And it's interesting in that scheme where they're, you know, the urban design principles are really coming to the fore. So the street line is being reinstated all the way around on Dorset Street on to the Black Church as well. In a way that's really reviving that whole neighbourhood by reinstating traditional street lines. And it's funny how the human reacts to the lack of an edge or the lack of a street edge. So that's quite heartening. And also there's an increase in the number of housing units in that case as well.
OK, so Graeme, what happens now with this site? Do we go in, photograph it, look at it, dig things out, leave it as it is, cover it over again?
I'm not sure what's particularly proposed on the York Street flats side where these basements have been discovered, but I'd imagine there is long-term plans, probably similar to reinstate the street edge there as well. Mm. It's interesting looking at the beautiful Mercer House complex, which you're probably familiar with. It was built in the 1930s, a lovely yellow brick scheme across the road. And in many ways, that had very lovely kind of swaggering urban design principles that I think we could take our cue from in the redevelopment of other schemes.
Yeah, indeed. Well, building will continue there to some extent or another for the next year or two. So if you're in the Dublin area around that, do have a look and see what's going on. Graeme Hickey, CEO of the Dublin Civic Trust. Thanks a million for coming on The Home Show.
The Home Show.
With Colour Trend. Infinite colour from Ireland.
This is News Talk. The Home Show.
With Colour Trend. Infinite colour from Ireland.
This is News Talk.
Now, we talk a lot about decorating and redecorating on The Home Show. It is why we are here, especially in our designer room slot every week. But this week, it takes a bit of a left turn, a bit sinister, a little bit dark. Can you redecorate too much? Are some people never happy? Does it become addictive? Well, who else to ask but the person who's possibly ticking all of those boxes? Or perhaps that's what his husband would say. The housewife of Drumcondra himself, Paul Kinsella. Hello.
It's me. I was like, yes, that is me. I change everything. And as you're saying that, I'm like, oh, I'd really love to change up the guest bedroom now.
See?
Yeah, I know.
Doing that even while we're talking.
Yeah.
So this is something called... This is a real thing.
Yeah,
right?
It is. Yeah.
This is a real thing.
It is.
Science, people. It's called the Diderot effect. Mm-hmm. Explain to listeners what it is, Paul.
So, as the Diderot, or if, because Dennis was from France, the Diderot. I never did French, but that
we'll
was just.
Take it.
Yeah, we'll take it. So, essentially, this came from a guy in France who got a house coat or a dressing gown, whichever way you prefer to call it. And it was really luxurious. And then he suddenly felt that his home didn't match it. So he wanted to change everything and make everything looks and shiny and expensive. On what budget? I don't know. But that's what he did. And then essentially it's about like a chain reaction in where you get something new and then suddenly everything else feels outdated. And then it kind of has this domino effect. So suddenly you buy something new, you put it in the space that it might be in, and then you're like, oh, that wall looks a bit crap and I need to paint that up a little bit, and maybe I need a new cushion, and maybe I need... And I can safely say I have recently done this in my back room because we got a new couch. So then suddenly I was like, oh, well, maybe I need to move the rad don't know why I need to move the rad. And I see you looking at me going, you're absolutely mad. Then I installed an acoustic slat wall myself. And now I've done a rug. And now I want some expensive art. And it's just, now I won't acknowledge the price of all these things. And
so was it, is it just that, like, and we've all experienced it, like, because, you know, you paint a wall, you paint your four walls in a room, and you realise, God, that ceiling is filthy.
Yes.
Now I have to go and paint the ceiling and the skirting boards and then the door. So we've all know what that feels like.
Yes.
But, like, the urge to change the whole room because of, like, one chair or one piece of furniture.
I know.
So I think you probably are a victim of this effect.
Oh, 100% right. And my husband just keeps saying, will you leave the house alone? It's absolutely fine. And I'm like, well, no, we could do a little change here and there.
So what are the psychological kind of drivers for this, do you think? What is deep-seated in here? Because it doesn't strike me as something change just for change's sake.
No, I think it's because you see something new against things that are a little bit more older, a little bit more worn, as you've said, in terms of the ceiling looking a bit more dirty against a fresh wall or the skirting boards. And I think it's then we feel it's out of place in that room because it's so shiny and new compared to what we've been living in.
So is it just like a temporary dopamine hit from getting a new piece and then the dissatisfaction of everything?
Absolutely.
Is that it?
So it's the dopamine hit of, yay, shiny new in the room. And then you're like, oh, well, now that I have to do that because it doesn't look as shiny and new as that thing. And then you get that feeling that you want it all to feel cohesive and look all the same in the same kind of nearly family or colour scheme.
And of course, some people, when I say some people, I mean women, do this with clothes often.
Yeah.
You know, you buy a top.
Yeah.
And you think, oh, that's lovely. I really like that. That'll go with these jeans or whatever. And then you realise, God, I've no shoes that are going to work with that.
Oh,
you know?
The shoe problem. Carrie Bradshaw, eat your heart out.
Yeah. So you can understand how that idea. And but Paul, to what extent do you think is because we don't think through the new purchase?
Yeah.
Or we just fall in love with that item and then everything around it has to change.
I think for me, I do definitely think about the whole aspect, but I suppose that's because I'm in the game of styling and DIY and upcycling and updating.
So you've no excuse.
So I've no excuse, but I do fall victim to it. But I think when you're doing a change like that, you should actually look at your space and say, okay, that's going to have maybe a knock-on effect because it needs to be repainted, the room, or are my cushion covers still going to fit in with that?
Okay.
So it's to kind of think a little bit more cleverly about
it. Okay. Now, you know, this Diderot effect, this feeling that we all have from time to time, there are certain kind of psychological markers that we're supposed to ask ourselves, like to see, are we victims of this? Are we suffering from it? We had in our clinical psychotherapist at the top of the show, Stephanie Regan, talking about, you know, life after divorce and reclaiming your space and all that. But I imagine she'd have something to say on this.
Yeah.
But we don't want to hear that. We don't want to hear what we shouldn't be doing. We want her just
Yeah. So, like, I suppose what we would look at then is it enhancing your room, enhancing your life in some sort of way? Or are you doing it for the sake of doing it? Is there something that you're putting off to kind of create this project in the background? And I suppose what I ask myself is, will that spark joy when I'm doing something? Or is that distracting me as well from doing something else? And I think, I always think if with big purchases like the couch, what's the end goal? What's the fix that you need to have in that whole room? Like, is it fixing a layout issue that maybe you, when you moved in initially, you never fixed or you never really thought about, and now because you're living in it?
So it mightn't be about the item at all. There might be a wider...
And also...
No, more than overbuying clothes or overeating. It's like, it's a short term thing, but there's a wider issue. Yeah.
100%.
Okay.
Yeah.
But you still do it.
Oh, I still do it. Because it brings me joy.
Tell me then the most likely things that we tend to fall victim to, this Diderot effect, when we want to kind of do a quick glow up or a quick change to kind of scratch that itch.
Yeah, I think Easy ones for me are the likes of living rooms or bedrooms. There's stuff there you can do really simply, and I think we've spoken about it before. And now as we're, dare I say it, going into like another season,
yeah,
you can start to change colour tones based on that season. And that might give you like a little plaster over that itch for something bigger. And then I also think we've now, since 2020, we've really focused on our home office. Mm. And I think sometimes for us, our space in the home office could do well with doing a refresh every now and again, because you're in it sometimes 5 days a week, sometimes 3 days a week. So like there are two areas that I would start in if, and then you can also look at your hallway, because your hallway is quite a small space.
It's always a good one, because
always a good one.
You
yeah.
can do it quickly. It gets a lot of wear, so you can always justify
100%
the glow up
yeah.
because, you know, there's people trucking in and out all
and you
the
don't
time.
Have huge amount of furniture technically in your hallway unless you're living in a grandeur mansion
yeah.
but like you might have a side table and you might have a lamp and you might have a mirror somewhere. Essentially they could probably stay, and then you're just inserting a pop accent colour, like maybe on a wall or a feature wall, maybe an art piece.
Yeah, and actually the hallway is great because it gives you that dopamine hit the second you walk
the minute
in the
you
door,
walk in the door
and you feel you've
yeah.
done something and it's changed up and
yeah.
it's productive. Now, is there a danger then, Paul, of the wider issue where you do up the hall and then you walk into your living room or kitchen and you go, ah, crap.
Yeah, there is an issue there, but I always say you should... I prefer my rooms to have different vibes. And I think we've spoken about this before. So my front room is very dark. I've done colour drenching all over it.
Yeah.
So it's like a
Me
dark...
Too. Yeah, 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 dark teal.
Yeah, and I've done dark green. And that's our kind of date night room. So it feels very different to our hall, which is open and inviting. So I always try to look at each room as its own individual entity rather than feeling... There's a flow throughout
the
whole...
There has to be a story arc yeah. throughout yeah. your house.
And some yeah. people, like one of my really good friends, have done the same story theme throughout the whole downstairs. And that's just their style.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's you protecting yourself from yourself.
That is me protecting right. myself. And I'm hoping my mother-in-law, my mother or my husband is not listening to this.
Okay, right, because they're going to be saying, nah,
yeah.
that's not the way it works. All right. Well, Paul, thank you very much. The Diderot effect is what it's called, D-I-D-E-R-O-T. And if you are a person who puts on a dress and says, I need to change this whole room to make it all match, well, then you are definitely suffering from that. So Paul is saying, go ahead, be a victim.
I am.
Indulge it. Lean into it. It is expensive, but listen, if it's what you need to scratch that itch, well then go ahead and do it. You'll get full permission from the Home Show. And that is all we have time for this week. You can find Paul on Life at Number 2. That's his Instagram handle. And lots of inspo there. So don't go there if you're suffering from the Diderot effect.
The Home Show.
With Colour Trend. Infinite colour from Ireland.
This is News Talk.
And that's it. That's all we have time for on this week's episode of the Home Show Pod. Hope you enjoyed it and the content. If you'd like to get in touch, recommend a guest, a topic you'd like us to cover, we would love to hear from you. thehomeshow@newstalk.com is the email, and you'll find me on X and Instagram, and I know people do get in touch with that. Don't forget to check out the pod if you've missed any other items or anything you'd like to listen back to. Thanks to Aoife Breen producing this week. Mia Sherwood was researching and Stephen McClune was on sound. We will see you all again next week when the next episode drops, and we'll do it all again.
The Home Show.
With Colour Trend. Infinite colour from Ireland.
This is News Talk.